Okay, so
first of all, I should start by saying thanks to the organizers.
Where's the organizer?
Not that. Here's the organizer.
Okay.
So thanks to the organizer for the opportunity to give this talk here.
Thank you, organizer.
Yes, this is what I was doing. My work has two parts, basically, that you will see the connection at a certain point. The first part is in collaboration with Jesus Rosado and Philip Lorenzo, and it's already a preprint that you can download somewhere in in the webpage of the university, for instance. And the second part is still a work in preparation that soon it will be finished, and part it has been done here. Collaboration with Stefano Licini and Giuseppe Savare from Pavia, and Dejan Slepcev from Carnegie Mellon. Okay, so let's see. Well, I don't need to introduce too much because it was very, very interesting, the talk of this morning by Christos Bauer. He discussed a lot about the modeling of this equation. So I don't have to explain too much from where this comes now. But you already heard this morning that in principle, we are interested about the evolution of certain equations of this form that we write it here for the purposes. So we have the FDP equals the Laplacian velocity of F plus divergence of 1 plus KF VF, where the K will be either plus or minus 1. And well, we're thinking about the evolution of a probability density in principle in Rn. Okay? And this equation is what was introduced by, well, as I found it in the literature, by Kaniadakis, as was already mentioned in this morning. And it's a model to for the evolution of this gases of quantum particles when you want to introduce this fermion or boson particle. Okay, so what's the difference from my point of view here? I mean, why this operator was chosen for doing that? So as I said, this was mentioned already this morning, but I would make it clear now in a sense. I mean, you do that just because this is the simplest operator that you can write that has Fermi, Dirac distribution and Bose-Einstein distribution as a steady state, basically. Because what you do is you write it like this. Write it like that. And here we write the graph B of B squared. B squared over 2 plus whatever it needs to be here. I don't care, it's a function of f. And it's easy to check that this exactly by looking at functions for which this is constant, you recover exactly the Fermi distribution for Bose-Einstein. So they are in the kernel of this operator. Okay? So, as you know, well, this will be in the next slide, so I probably don't have to say too much. So, Bose-Einstein distribution will be of this form. With beta is a positive parameter, or Fermi-Dirac, which you are taking into account this Pauli's closures principle, then there will be of this form, where beta again is a positive parameter. Exactly what I said there and how I wrote it there is written here, where the h of f, precisely written here what it is, log f minus log of 1 plus kf, and there what you see clearly why Fermi-Dirac and Bose-Einstein are in the kernel of this operator, in a sense. Okay? Well, so what was the objective of what we started here? So we wanted to study carefully the long-time asymptotics of this model, which corresponds to the spatially homogeneous case of the equation that was treated this morning, but without any assumption of the smallness on initial data, just to try to develop a theory based on entropy dissipation that tells me exactly if I go to the steady state and rate of convergence to the steady state and so on, okay? So there will be two parts, as I said, one in which I will concentrate more in the point of view of entropy dissipation inequalities, will be this part. By the way, I will will skip many details that are written there, not to bother too much after a long day. And then I will concentrate on some aspects of optimal transport related to these equations. So, well, I'm going to concentrate in the case of the fermions, and I will tell you differences in the case of the Bose-Einstein and what are the problems that we don't understand yet in the case of Bose-Einstein. Okay? So this is the part that I've done in collaboration with Philippe Lorenzo and Jesus Rosado. Jesus Rosado is a PhD student of mine, so he's part of his thesis in the future. He's around here, so you can also ask him about all details that you are interested in at certain point. So I will just give some details of the system theory for the equation to tell you that the main difference between fermions and bosons, and that we will know at the end, is that for fermions, we are basically able to prove global existence of solution. I'll tell you, well, basically you can see what's the difference. The difference is a sign, but a sign, as you know, is very important if you are talking about f squared and minus f squared. Okay, so that's what you see, one simple difference, but I will tell more in detail what are the main difficulties here. So for fermions in any dimension here, by the way, this morning, Sparber referred to a small note that we wrote together with Jesus Rosado and Francesco Salvarani. That note was only for one-dimensional case, okay? And in the one-dimensional case, it's much easier to certain things. Here I'm talking about the general dimensional case, okay? So in order to develop the system theory for this equation, you just are gonna work with the Duhamel formula, in principle. So what you treat your own nonlinearity as a right-hand side, as usually you do, and you just write the equation in terms of the Duhamel formula with the fundamental solution on the linear part of the Fokker-Hund domain that you know explicitly, okay? So basically you are gonna work at this with this operator, T of F, to find the system of solution in your case. This operator formulation over here and here, this refers to a kind of convolution. It's not really a convolution because of the form of the fundamental solution. It refers just to this integral against the fundamental solution of the linear Fokker-Prandtl operator, which I remind you what it is. This is really explicit. And it has this formula over here. Okay. So the first thing that you had to do is to develop a good local existence theory for these equations. What I'm going to say right now is exactly the same for Bose-Einstein. It doesn't change a single comment. I mean, I'm talking about right now local existence, okay? So what are the right spaces? What you find for local existence? So the space in which we were basically is L infinity intersection with an LP space with certain moments. M will be the number of moments that you are considering in the velocity space. So, just to summarize things, well, I mean, it's just definition of what is the corresponding norm, which is not too important. That's the maximum of the norms in the spaces which we have there. Just the notation, LPM, so I refer to the LP norm of 1 plus e to the mf, okay? So, working in that space, and after a lot of pain using these inequalities on the derivatives of the fundamental solution of the Fokker-Prandtl operator, you can develop which are estimates that some of them already existed and were used in the case of the Navier-Stokes vorticity equation on two dimensions. So you just use this kind of estimates to prove your fixed point argument in this space and have your local time system theory, okay? Which is, as is written here, this assumptions on P and M comes precisely because of the control of all these integrals that appear when you do the estimates. So you need P large enough and larger than dimension, or at least M larger or equal than 1. And then, given an initial data in that space, you can recover a unique solution in that space. Okay? This is your local system theory, both for Fermi Dirac and Bose-Einstein. As I said, for both the local theory will be exactly the same. Of course, the time depends on the node initial data. as soon as you control the norm of the initial data, you can continue extending the solution. Okay, so this is the typical local assistant theory that helps you to construct global solutions. Then, if you are able to show certain a priori estimates, so next step, you are going to show a priori estimates. What's the big difference between fermions and bosons from the point of view of having a priori estimate is that for Fermi-Dirac, you have an L-infinity estimate for free. That's the big difference. If the initial data is less or equal than 1, which is not an assumption, a restricted assumption, it's a physical assumption, because this is precisely related to Pauli's question principle. If F initially is less or equal than 1, it remains less or equal than 1 for any time, and you have an L-infinity estimate for free. That's the first big difference between one and the other. If you try to obtain LP estimates for Bose-Einstein, you will see that having the other sign, if you do the typical computation multiplying by f to the p and iterate, you see that they go with the wrong sign and you don't get any global time estimate. That's one of the big differences. So, well, this is more or less what we did in this first part of the a priori estimates. So, well, first you have to show that initial data which are positive remain positive. You show, this is what I was referring to, this is the important estimate that you prove Fermi-Dirac, if initial is less or equal than 1, it remains less or equal than 1 for all times. By the way, the choice of 1 here is just a normalization, okay? It has nothing to do with the fact that we are dealing with probability densities, okay? Well, you have mass conservation, as formally you have from the equation. The equation is mass preserves mass. You can prove comparison principles in this case. You have, in fact, an L1 contraction estimate, which is helpful in certain things. And you can control moments. In principle, what I mean by controlling moments in this lemma, don't read it if it's too complicated to read it, just what's the idea, what do we prove? Is just that we can control moments in any finite time interval, okay? This lemma just says that in any finite time interval, all moments can be controlled if initially are bounded. This doesn't tell you that they are uniformly bounded in time. That's another question, okay? In fact, that's another big difference between the two cases. If you try to control moments for this equation, you see that for Bose-Einstein, it's quite easy to show uniform time control of moments formally, but for Fermi-Dirac it's not. For Fermi-Dirac, what is difficult is to control uniform in time the moments. That's just by multiplying by the corresponding power of being iterating and see what you get. Okay? So so the global assistance then just goes from the fact that previously we have a local time assistant based on the L infinity plus LPM space, or L1 MP space, so certain number of moments bounded. And now what we have done is to prove an a priori estimate of the L infinity and a priori estimate of moments for all time. This means that, just arguing by contradiction, you can continue extending the solution for all times because you have these a priori estimates. Okay? So this is basically the globalist instance in the case of Fermi-Dirac, once you have done all this work. I'm simplifying things in how I present. Of course, there are plenty of technical details to check everything after that. Okay, so now we have global assistance. I haven't told you anything on the asymptotic behavior. What happens with asymptotic behavior? So the first thing is that you have a natural associated entropy function. I guess that half of the audience have already guessed what's the entropy function, just by reading the equation. So if you look at it in this form, you clearly see that this equation, formally at least, can be written like divergence in B of F of F 1 plus KF. Grad V of the variational derivative of this as Brian's page. Okay? And you see also that the entropy dissipation will be, as usual as for a Fokker transformation, will have f times the square of this, but now you have also 1 plus kf. Okay? So you have that the derivative in, formally at least, the derivative in t of that function I will call e of f. Well, I probably will change the name right in the slide, but I think I call it h. So it's minus f 1 plus kf, the gradient squared of this thing. Okay? sorry about the, yes, h. Okay. Good. So effectively, I call, this is a big, big, big. I call, yes, it's very good that I call it now h, because it's going to be h. Okay, because e is going to be the kinetic energy. Sorry. E is going to be this, and this is going to be s of f. Okay. Good. So you have this natural entropy, which where we are working on. All the value of the entropy, in fact, is negative because we are in the interval 0, 1. F only takes values in the interval 0, 1. We have this L infinity bound. As I said, the E refers to the kinetic energy. And, well, so once you realize that you have this entropy functional, the first theorem that you can get is just by entropy methods. So you want to get a decay, convergence result to the equilibrium, but in principle without decay rate. The only thing that you have to do is to ensure that you can control the interval in time of the entropy dissipation to tell you some compactness and to prove that the interval in time of the dissipation will converge to zero as t goes to infinity and deduce from that the convergence. So this is precisely the first result we do.
You are talking about especially homogeneous Boltzmann quantum equation.
Right.
Yeah, you well for fermions it's exactly the same.
It's exactly the same.
Yeah, you
for
want
for bosons
also, yes.
For
I mean yes,
yeah.
Talking about fermions.
Right.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Okay, dissipation is different.
Yeah, into the dissipation is different.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Where is
yes.
K there? Sorry.
K. What's K? Well, that one is fermions. I'm talking about fermions.
Okay, okay.
Only.
Sorry.
This is all only fermions, okay? That's what we're here and talking about here. Because it's the only one that I have now global assistance,
okay.
And
yeah.
So because of what I mentioned. I talk about the Bose-Einstein right after what we know, we don't know, okay? So, okay, so, yes. So one of the things that you have to face when you do this first say approach to have a convergence without rate to the Fermi-Dirac distribution is that at certain point you will need to control the negative part of the entropy, which in this case this is general. Okay, in this case it's total entropy because this is negative. This is what some people call Kalman estimate or things like that. When you need to control the negative part of the entropy in terms of the moment. Here it's a bit more difficult to do this, but we are able to do that. So this is the lemma that you need, is that the entropy, minus the entropy which is positive, you can control it in terms of the second moment. So for any epsilon in 0, 1, you can prove that minus the entropy is less or equal than an epsilon of the kinetic kinetic energy plus a constant, okay? And this is important to get the a priori estimates because you want to show that the second moment and the negative part of the entropy, both of them are uniformly bounded in time when you want to pass to the limit. You want to have the weak start, the weak L1 compactness, okay? That's why you need that. So you want to obtain from the fact that the entropy is decreasing and the fact that the entropy is larger or equal than its minimum value, which is attached, is achieved at the Fermi-Dirac distribution, you want to derive from that
that you have uniform bubbles both on the second moment and the entropy uniform in time. That's the point. You are going to get them uniform in time. So this is the key argument that you are going to just, well, this is just what I said. Just because of the monotonicity of the entropy functional, you will have that the entropy functional is in between the value of initially and the minimum value of the functional that is achieved to the corresponding direct distribution with the same mass. And from there, this is the result that you will get. I already announced what you will get. It's just that your global intense solution will converge, in fact, strongly in L1 towards the Fermi Dirac distribution with the same mass, without any rating principle. Okay, this just uses typical entropy argument that is back to, I don't know, to many people at the beginning of the 90s for Boltzmann equation in U1. But the argument in this case has certain technical details, as I mentioned to you before, with the control of the entropy in terms of the second moment and certain other technical details. I think I was thinking of showing you a bit of the details, but I think I'm going to skip them. You are very, very tired, and probably me too. So I think that's the first result. If you don't assume, if you don't assume nothing else on the initial data, we have only convergence to the Fermi Dirac without any rate, okay? If you want to have convergence with a rate, this is, this is, so let's talk about Fermi Dirac, so this minus one here. So this is related, in fact, to things that, we did in the past for nonlinear Fokker Planck equations. Because if you realize that that equation and the following equation I'm going to write over here with a different notation, not to make mistakes. So rho will depend on time and space. And here I will have just rho, and here I will have grad x, this divergence. Modulus of x squared over 2 plus h of rho, and the h is the same, okay? If you look at it, this equation has exactly the same entropy as for the Fermi Dirac equation. And the entropy dissipation is what it is different, of course, the 1 minus f is not present here. But if you are able to control f in some way above, not just by 1, not just simply that the L infinity norm of f is less or equal than 1. You can say something more that is controlled by something, then you can get rid of this and have exactly the same entropy dissipation as for this nonlinear diffusion Fokker Planck equation. Okay? So that's precisely the idea to get the decay rate. And the decay rate is based on the idea of, well, this is a first theorem in that direction. If your initial data is below a Fermi Dirac already with a different mass, so it's controlled by a Fermi Dirac from above, due to the comparison principle, since it's a stationary solution, this one, the solution will remain below this Fermi Dirac for all times. So this means that really 1 minus f is bounded away from 0. Okay, my problem is to bound away from 0 1 minus f. So in that case, 1 minus f is bounded away from 0, and then you can say that this is less or equal than minus a constant, integral f, grad of this functional, grad of this. And now you have exactly the same entropy dissipation as for this equation. And then what you do? You do that, you use the generalization of the Lotzsovel inequalities that is available for this. You have the generalization of Lotzsovel inequalities that we did in the paper with our main organizer, Jungel, Unterreiter, and Toscani in which precisely you say that for a general class of nonlinear diffusion equation of this form, you can control the relative entropy in terms of the dissipation of entropy. But this gives you, not only it gives you that for solution, but it's a functional inequality. You can derive a functional inequality, which is the replacement of the Lotzsovolev inequality in that case. And that precise inequality is the one that you're going to use here to end up with these kind of results. So you're going to have that then the relative entropy decays exponentially, where the constant depends exactly on this norm of 1 minus f in L infinity. And from there, you can obtain the convergence in L1. Okay? So the idea, as I said, is this comparison is written here, but I was just saying anything worse, is to compare with the nonlinear Fokker-Planck equation of this form, which has, as I said, this entropy dissipation, and since you control 1 minus f, you have that, and you use this generalized Lotzsovolev inequality that we have in that paper, and that's basically what you do in that case. Okay? So, as I told you, the main problem here with Fermi-Dirac is to control uniformly time the moments. With this trick with the entropy, what you can control is only the second moment, uniformly in time. If you want to control more moments, or more than k at infinity to v, this is something where we don't know how to do it in general. And we were at least able to do it for radial cases. So in the case in which it's radial, in fact, so in the case in which it's radial, and we have an initial data with a certain number of moments, arbitrarily large, then we can control uniformly in time the corresponding moment. This we can do only in the radial case, and immediately, of course, you have the same similar result for other initial data that you can compare to radial solutions of this form. Okay, and this this result also allow us to improve a little bit the convergence result without rate. Because the convergence result without rate was just telling you that you are converging strongly in L1, but you don't know even if the functional, the relative entropy converges to its minimum. At least we can improve to that and say that if you have our initial data with this number of moments bounded, which is bounded above by a radial function, a radial symmetric function with a second moment bounded, then we can prove that really the not only f of t converges in L1 to the Fermi-Dirac, but also the relative entropy converges to zero. Okay? So, as I said here, to improve to the decay rate, the problem is that you don't control well the behavior of the distribution, the tails of the distribution uniformly in time. Good. So, more or less, in any case, more or less for fermions in any dimension, this closes in some sense, what is the asymptotic behavior is clear. What is not clear is how to get better decay rates. But the asymptotic behavior is completely clear in that case. Okay, what about the Bose-Einstein? So this was already mentioned by Christoph this morning. This, of course, depends on dimension, because it depends on the integrability or not of the function 1 over e v squared over 2 minus 1. Okay, which is the maximal parameter in which you can go, and this remains positive, of course. So this function is integrable if and only if dimension is larger or equal than 3. Okay, this means that if you're in dimension 1 or dimension 2, for each value of the mass, you have a unique equilibrium Bose-Einstein distribution function, which is the actual candidate to the asymptotic behavior, the long time asymptotic of the equation. But in dimension larger than 3, larger or equal than 3, so this means that there is a critical value of the mass. In which sense is critical? In the sense that only below that value of the mass you have a candidate to. Nevertheless, you have this formally you have this entropy dissipation. And formally you have this this conservation of mass. I say formally because I mean this is precisely what one has to understand. Because if the mass is larger than mc, although you formally have this conservation of mass and although you have formally this decay of the corresponding entropy, there is no natural candidate to be in the long time asymptotics. So what the function does as it goes to infinity, I mean, we don't know really if the solution first is defined globally. We don't know. And we don't know even in that, in dimension three, what happens asymptotically. We can answer the question in 1D. In 1D, in fact, again, by this idea of comparing to nonlinear diffusions, we can manage. And we can manage again.
Why not in 2D?
Yeah, because the what it changes is the entropy. The little h over here now is log of rho minus log of 1 plus rho. And the problem is the condition of having the log Sobolev inequality or not. In one dimension is satisfied, in two dimensions is not. So we don't know how to make use of the of this comparison to the nonlinear diffusion case in 2D, while in 1D things work well, and in fact they work well even for the dissipation of the entropy. No, in 2D we don't know basically anything because we don't have this kind of inequality. We don't have the log Sobolev inequality.
I think this in 2D is also critical, as you said. I think there should be.
No, but there is the structure. Is the nonlinearity? Is the age? I mean, I'm not talking about the mass or not the mass, but it's just the age. I mean, I'm not saying that they're not expecting that.
Okay.
I don't know how to prove it.
Okay.
I expect it's true. I don't know how to prove it. Okay, that's different. In so that's more or less the situation. I think it's worth it. Probably how many minutes do I have left?
Ten.
Okay, so great. So probably it's worth it that I mention what?
15.
Ah, thanks.
Can I tell?
It's a good trade. No, it's okay, 15. So, so probably it's good to mention again about other differences of Bose-Einstein. Probably that's not the things that I don't know. So let's talk about the upper problems here. If you look at the equation in that case, as I say, it's trivial basically to have global uniform bounds of moments in formal, which is not trivial at all, is how to estimate LP norms. I don't know how to estimate LP norms in an effective way there, because precisely the change of sign makes you appear terms which are higher order with the wrong sign, and I don't know how to estimate it. Okay? Well, till now, there was no optimal transport. No? So now let's see what's the connection with optimal transport, all of this. So the connection with optimal transport and gradient flows goes through this idea, the idea of writing the equation in this form. As some of you know, there is a whole theory about how to give a sense to gradient flows of equations which can be written in this way. Okay? The way in which you work with them is because you think about them as gradient flows with respect to a distance, which is called the Euclidean versus time distance, or the transport distance, for which the continuity equation with just the continuity equation, this equation, with the vector field given by minus the gradient, is precisely formally the equation of the gradient flow. So we started thinking then of a generalization of these ideas to equations of this more general form. So let's write the form first. So now there is a whole change of notation. Sorry about that, because you know, it's I already prepared you about that. So that's the different notation. So
here I put it in general terms now. So I have a general internal energy, which plays the role of the entropy here, and a general given confinement potential, which is this functional V, which corresponds to this part. And then that equation, as I said already, as I wrote it already there, can be written formally as a nonlinear continuity equation now, okay, with this function M, like called the mobility function, depending on rho. The energy functional or relative entropy functional would be just a sum of these two functionals. And for fermions, this is what it is M. For bosons, this is what is in M. And in fact, there are plenty of other models that can be included in this form. Models that appear in mathematical biology, some Keller-Siegel models, models that were developed by Dejan Slepchuk, and he talked about it in the first workshop, by the way. They can be written formally in this form. Okay. So let's see. Well, I'm going to tell you more or less what I know about this approach of using optimal transport techniques in this direction. There are plenty of other things that we don't know, but we know already certain things. So the first thing is that, of course, you have to change the distance. You cannot use the Bassenstein distance, but a different distance, which will be defined by the Grenier-Benamou-like formula, or the dynamic formula, or the fluid dynamics point of view for the optimal transport, in which you just change here rho tx by n of rho tx. Well, and then you can define at least formally this transport distance. So what you are going to do is you're going to take, sorry, I didn't say what I have there. You're going to take A here is the set of all functions or all curves in the set of measures joining mu to nu, such that they verify the continuity equation, and that initially one is initially is mu, and at the end point is nu. Okay? This is at least the definition by all of the characterization by Benamou and Renier in the case M of rho is rho. Okay, so you can define this distance. And in fact, there has been a very recent result in this direction by Jean Dolbeau, Nazaré and Savaré. This is a preprint of December 2007, in which they work with this distance and they give conditions under which this distance is well defined. And it, they study all properties of the distance. What I mean by properties is that they prove that there is really a distance between measures, that it induces the weak start topology, that lower semi-continuous in both of the arguments, many of the properties that are useful for the Bassenstein distance, and even more, they prove the system of geodesics for this distance, okay? And the assumption that they had to do on the mobility function is that it's concave and increasing, okay? Those are the assumptions that they had to do on the mobility function. If you look at our two cases, well, Bose-Einstein is M of rho is rho times 1 plus rho, which is convex, which, so we start badly. If you look at Fermi-Dirac, is concave, but it's not increasing, okay? So none of the two is included, but by the way, we already realized that this part of increasing you can work on that and get rid of that if you reduce to certain type of measures which are infinity bounded, basically. Well, it seems that by now the assumption of concavity of M of rho is what it seems essential. Why you need the concavity? Because the idea is, I don't know if I have it here written or not, so no. Why you need the concavity is because typically you're gonna work with the momentum rather with the velocity. So you're gonna multiply by m and divide by m, put the m of rho inside to have the j squared, the momentum squared divided by m. And then you want that integrand to be jointly convex. And for that, m of rho has to be concave. So by now, that says what it seems essential, this concavity of m by now. Essential for their results.
If I change the m, the whole square,
But they don't know, yeah, so. I agree with you, but for all the theory that they develop here, it seems essential to have what I meant. Yes. It's consistent. Yeah, it's not, Okay, yeah, I understand your point. Okay. Yeah, exactly, delta, what it means for the, I understand your point. Yeah, I'm gonna explain just that now. Okay, so geodesic. So the thing is, most of the results for the other kind, the kind of equation of this form, most of the results by using optimal transport techniques are based on the static convexity properties of the corresponding functional with respect to the minimal curves joining, minimal distance curves joining two measures with respect to the corresponding distance. So what are the so-called geodesics of the corresponding distance. So we wanted to see here under which conditions our functionals were convex with that notion of convexity, which is called displacement convexity, okay? So you can do first your heuristic calculus. And this heuristic calculus is based on the same ideas that they were done formally by several people, René for sure, and Felix Soto also. And the idea is just that in order to write the formal equations for the geodesics, you just write your definition of your distance. You put the constraint on the minimization problem as a Lagrange multiplier, if you want. And this is what I did in the weak formulation. So the Lagrange multiplier, in fact, is just a test function for the nonlinear continuity equation. And then you look at the optimality conditions with respect to rho, v, and psi. And you get these three, so the constraint. You have that the v is graded psi. And finally, you have this equation also for the evolution of psi. And that's the formal equation that the geodesics will follow. So it's like what you have in the other case, which is Hamilton-Jacobi, which M prime would be 1, and you have this thing, okay? It's completely formal by now, because we don't know how to obtain the geodesics in this distance. This is not known. The construction of the system of the geodesic is proved by them in their paper, by Dolbo, Nazare, and Savare. But there is no specific characterization like in the case of the Bassel-Stein distance that you can work with. So we just wrote the formal equation of the geodesics. And then, of course, you can compute the derivatives and see when it's convex. So what I mean by the derivatives? I mean that this is going to give you your minimizing curve in this problem, and you want to know when the functional of the energy, the h or the e in this notation, is convex with respect to s along this curve rho s. So that's why you compute u of rho s and you derive first and second derivative. I start with the internal energy. So these are the formulas you get. Well, to get these formulas, of course, you have to work a bit, but you are already train with the case in which n of rho was rho, so you know more or less what you have to do. But this really takes a while to realize that this is the way to write it in the nice formula to compute. And then you can identify how you can, the assumptions you need to prove that the second derivative is positive. Because basically it's like a generalization of the other case. So first, you define a certain function p. Well, let me write over here the equation. Formally, the gradient flow equation that we are looking at now is this, okay? That notation is exactly this. Okay, so the p function that is defined there is just to write the equation in this way. Okay? And, well, that's the definition of the p. And then there is another function g that appears in the computation, over here, which is the derivative is related to the P and the M in this way. So the thing is that now, using Buchner formula, which is exactly what you use also in the case of the Euclidean Wasserstein distance, you bound from below the second derivative by all these two terms. And then you really see the two assumptions that at least tells you that the second derivative is positive. First, here you see, well, the p is increasing, so this derivative is always positive. Here you see that concavity of m will give you that this term is positive. And here you have a condition that generalizes the Machan's condition for displacement convexity. So you take m of r equals 2r, you recover precisely Machan's condition. So under concavity of m and generalized Machan's displacement convexity assumption in this way, formally at least the second derivative of this is positive, okay? So this tells you that you expect these functionals to be convex and to have certain results using optimal transport if you have these two assumptions verified in your problem, okay? So, no, this is all dimensional, this is all dimensions. This is all dimensions, yeah. Yeah, Hessian, that like, yeah. Yeah, all dimensions. Okay. In 1D? No, in 1D, you see, 1D is, you see in 1D. D equals 1, this disappear, so it's much simpler. All these disappear in 1D. You see? So this condition doesn't tell you anything in 1D, because P prime is positive, M is positive. This condition is trivially satisfied in 1D. That's the difference. In 1D, it's, yeah. In 1D, this is trivial, this is always satisfied. So, I think since I don't have too much time to say, I had some information. Well, the thing is, nevertheless, although we don't know what are the geodesics, we can prove that you have. We can give a sense to this equation without the, well, this equation with the as a gradient flow with respect to of this function with respect to this distance and obtain this decay of the distance in that case. Well, this decay, no, this is not a decay, no, this property of evolution of the distance. And how this is done? Well, I just mentioned reference. I mean, we use a strategy that it has been introduced very recently by Daneri and Savaret. This is a preprint of January this year, in which they give a proof of the displacement convexity for the Wasserstein distance that doesn't use the explicit formula given by Grenier theorem of the geodesics in the Euclidean Wasserstein distance. So it's a way of proving the convexity once you have only the systems of geodesics. And of course you have to work to prove this. And I will not show you how it goes this strategy. If you're interested in, this is precisely my next four slides and I can explain it to you offline, okay? And so the final result is this. Under those conditions, as I said, this displacement convexity condition and the concavity on M, probably I don't have it written there, but it's it's also. Sorry about that. Under these two conditions, then your functional is convex. It's displacement convex. This we can prove, and we can prove also a contraction property in terms of this distance for this equation. Okay. And just to finish, some bad or good news, as you want. This means that there is still a lot of work to do, is what happens with the Stirner potential. So, with the Stirner potential, you can do the same, you can compute the derivatives. And if you go to the second derivative, we have a negative result. what I mean by the negative result is that with this heuristic formula, we cannot prove rigorously, but with this heuristic formula, we can construct certain velocity fields, psi, and certain densities, rho, such that the second derivative is positive. So, negative, I said it right. I'm very tired now. Okay, so second derivative is negative. So in principle, if you assume that this formula is completely correct, which is not the case, but then this functional is not displacement convex. So in principle, these two models, they don't, we don't know if they are displacement convex. In a sense, the only hope would be that if you put it together with the other term, which is convex, then you can compensate. Or if you have some other properties on the solution, that you may compensate the lack of convexity of this guy. But this we don't know. What we know is that by itself is not displacement convex. And that's the point in which we are in this direction. So thank you very much.